This is Stephanie Rubel from the Stanford Alumni Association. I'd like to welcome you to our third book of the 2012-2013 Book Salon season, Jane Austen's Emma. This month, I'm delighted to introduce our host and author, John Bender, Doyle Professor in Interdisciplinary Studies, Professor of English and Comparative Literature, and former Director of the Stanford Humanities Center. John has been a Stanford faculty member for many years. His fields of interest lie chiefly in literature of the 18th century, women's writing of the period's last decades, and the French novel. John's most recent book was just published, Ends of Enlightenment, by the Stanford University Press. Thank you so much for kicking off this month's discussion, John.
Thank you, and I thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be able to imagine that friends out there are reading Austen's fantastic novel.
Can you tell our readers why you chose this book?
I chose Emma to read with you because I love Austen and I enjoy teaching her novels, even though her main works lie just outside my very special period of research, which is the 18th century. In fact, though, there are a few pages on Pride and Prejudice in one of the essays in that book that you just heard mentioned. I'll tell you a secret about myself. Whenever I decide to reread Austen's Pride and Prejudice, I have to be sure that I start early in the day because I can't put the book down until I've turned all the pages and actually finished it, even if this means reading into the night. Elizabeth Bennet's story casts a spell over me that can be broken only when I finish the book. I imagine you've had similar experiences with various novels, if not with Austen's. So in many ways, I'm a general reader, like most of you who are tuning in to these comments. You can appreciate her novels, whether you're young, middle-aged, or old, and whether you read fast or read for every detail. At any age, you can see the aptness of her cool, crisp, often satiric depictions of human desires and foibles. Depictions of English life that have long survived their own times and still grip readers who have little knowledge of dowries, cottagers, muslins, kinds of carriages, or the picturesque in landscape. Emma is longer and more complex than Pride and Prejudice, and this is why I picked it. This novel is too big to read in a day, but it rewards us both with a rich array of complex characters and also grants us the magical power actually to enter the minds of characters, most especially Emma herself. Austen was so good at showing the thoughts of her characters as if they were present to our own minds that it used to be said that hers were the first English novels to narrate first-person thoughts in the third person. Frances Burney, in fact, showed her the way, but Austen remains the Horowitz of this technique. Emma draws a panorama of a limited but socially and economically substantial world. Austen knew this world of the landed or would-be landed gentry from observations at its fringes. You can imagine, for instance, a young lady on a chair at the edge of a ballroom. It was indeed a world of independent wealth held by gentlemen and some ladies, but it was not a world of titled aristocrats. Very few of this kind of character appears in Austen's works. She was one of several children of a well-connected clergyman father and a very, very well-connected mother. They were from good families. She did turn down a proposal of marriage, but not from the young man she apparently loved. Neither of them had the money to marry at the time, though later he became Lord Chief Justice of Ireland. Instead, she lived with her parents and moved about as they did, from Steventon, where she was born in 1775 in the county of Hampshire, to Bath, to Southampton, to Chawton, and with visits to London along the way. Of course, Austen wrote, and from a very early age, since hers was a family that, like the Brontes in this one way, played literary games, did sketches, skits, parodies, and even proto-novels. These were their regular entertainments. And Austen's novels do entertain us, but with the underlying seriousness that marks the most enduring kinds of comedy. We laugh at her cutting wit, but we also gain perspective on other people's mistakes and our own. It's worth thinking for a moment about how we read novels, especially when we're in the presence of classics, which can tend to make us rather stiff and intimidated. It is clear that we read differently on different occasions. In fact, current research at Stanford, in which the brains of readers are scanned while they read, suggests that rapid reading for pleasure taps into different parts of the brain than does detailed analytic reading. I've already confessed that sometimes I read Austen voraciously. I read Pride and Prejudice almost as I might read a detective novel. After all, it is clear that Elizabeth and Darcy must get together, but how can this possibly happen since they detest one another? Austen showed that she knew all about this kind of reading in a passage in her early novel, Northanger Abbey. This is a parody of the popular Gothic novels of the 1790s when she wrote this book, though it was published later. She dismisses people who patronize novels and say things like, "Oh, it's just a novel," when asked what they're reading. They were reading for plot, quick pleasure, and mystery, just as we do. But we know from this same book and from letters that Austen read lots of light fiction too. Still, she poses the serious novel as an alternative. Her ideal was Frances Burney, whose novels for Austen were works, quote, in which the greatest powers of the mind are displayed, in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineations of its varieties, the liveliest diffusions of wit and humor are conveyed to the world in the best chosen language. She knows that such novels can be read in the quick way, but they're written with a depth that asks readers to ponder their world. You can read Emma either way, and I'll be very happy either way, and I'll bet that you will too.
Wonderful. What issues from Emma can you single out that readers might find interesting to discuss?
Well, Emma, who's a 21-year-old girl, doesn't seem so very urgently in need of a husband as Elizabeth. Pride and Prejudice starts with saying that such a girl needs a husband. But the question of marriage has to be there continually in the novel, in any novel that begins with the words, and I quote, "Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich," end quote. The marriage question is there implicitly in those very words. It is asked more in the background and at a slower pace than in Pride and Prejudice. Still, as you read, you could be noticing the marriage plot of Emma and how it works. How Austen asks us to place Emma's marriage in social context along with the traits and marriages of her other characters. The detective story dimension is very much present in Emma as well. Not only the question about Emma's ultimate partner, which you'll be asking, but also the mystery that centers around Jane Fairfax. Are there ways in which Emma makes you think of Raymond Chandler?
I'm really looking forward to reading this novel. Will you share a passage you consider representative of the book and talk to us about why you chose it?
Thank you. I'd like to. I'll leave you with some special passages to think about when you're reading Emma. You'll find a number of them in the later parts of the book. In them, Austen unobtrusively brings us into the mind of her heroine. This is a really magical effect that we take too much for granted when we read fiction in which it's become a frequent way of writing. For we can't enter the minds of other people in real life. You'll know more about Emma as you read this book than you know about any real person in the world. Even a parent, a spouse, a sibling, or, if you have one, a lover. We just can't do this in real life. Yet Austen makes it seem so natural and so true. Look at several passages in Volume 3, Chapter 11 of Emma. And I'll just note here that books like this were published in volumes and that you could buy them or rent them at a library volume by volume. So if you didn't like the book, you didn't have to continue. So these are moments when we plunge into Emma's mind, seeing it in the third-person narrative texture of the novel. That's third person, not in the first person I, even though these are first-person thoughts that we are to imagine Emma's having. Look at the part beginning, I quote, "The rest of the day and the following night were hardly enough for her thoughts," end quote. This is on page 284 of the edition I've recommended. The text then launches into a series of reflections and self-recriminations on Emma's part. Quote, "How to understand it all? How to understand the deceptions she had thus been practicing on herself and living under? The blunders, the blindness of her own head and heart," end quote. You might hear another person say something like this, but you'll never be in their heads when they're thinking and not talking. This is why our bond to Austen's characters seems so intimate and personal. We are in their heads, as if they were our own heads, but strangely different and objective. If you've not read Emma before, I can only say that I rather envy you that first fresh encounter with this side of Austen's genius. If you have read this novel before, then you can reread it with the wonderful layers that knowing while pretending not to know can bring. Either way, I hope you'll come to see why it is often said that Emma is Austen's greatest work.
John, thank you so much for providing us all that background. And thank you again for introducing Emma to our Book Salon community.